Judy Rebick supports Rabble because
Rabble's one of the very few spaces anywhere that you get a variety of views. All the new movements that emerged in Canada, whether it was Idle No More, the Maple Spring, the first place they appear is on Rabble.
Thanks, Judy. Just a few reasons to support Rabble.ca. Go to www.rabble.ca/donate.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Ears on the Earth, Rabble.ca at the World Social Forum. Welcome to Ears on the Earth. I'm Victoria Fenner, and I'm here in Montreal. It's a big, noisy city. You might be able to hear some of the traffic outside our window here. And the World Social Forum is the big news this week. The World Social Forum starts tomorrow, and we'll have a lot of information for you about just what that's all about. And we'll be doing a show every day here from Montreal. But there's another conference that's happening concurrently with the World Social Forum. It's called the World Forum for Free Media. And Dave Kattenberg and I have been there all day. So hi, Dave.
Hi, Victoria.
I'm so glad that you're able to join me because there's an awful lot to talk about. There's an awful lot to listen to, an awful lot to capture with our recorder so that we could play it tonight. And the people who weren't able to make it, they could come and they could be there along with us.
And it's been an incredibly intense day.
Okay, so we'll be sharing some of the things that we've heard and that we've learned. So first up, here's an introduction by co-chair Gretchen King.
So in preparation for the World Forum on Free Media, we acknowledge these events are proposed to take place on the traditional territory of the Kanahanikeha Mohawks. The island of Montreal is known as Jojage in the language of the Kanahanikeha. Historically, this location was a meeting place for other Indigenous nations, including the Anishinaabe Algonquin peoples. We invite all participants to learn more about resistance to colonialism and the role of communication technology in these struggles, and that's one of the themes that we're going to be hearing about this morning. With regard to the visa refusals, the World Forum on Free Media issued this statement. Visa refusals, a hindrance to freedom of expression. The World Social Forum begins in Montreal with a serious problem. A large number of guests from the Global South have either had their Canadian visas rejected or withheld. Today, we estimate that more than 200 visas have been denied or blocked for WSF participants, including 10 partners from the World Forum on Free Media coming from Latin America and Africa. Their voices are therefore confiscated from the work of constructing another world with real democracy, social justice, equality, pluralism, and respect for human rights. Freedom of expression is inseparable from freedom of movement. Without guaranteeing the right to participation in speech, the World Social Forum and its thematic forums, such as the World Forum on Free Media, cannot be built without the expression of different perspectives, without the presence of participation from the Global South. How can diversity be observed in the world fully and have it represented at the World Forum of Free Media and in the World Social Forum? If we restrict our diversity, how then can we talk about freedom of expression? The refusals of visas reveals a reality in which the current functioning of the world closes in on itself and rules out differences and the expression of citizenship. Does this mean that people from the Global South can no longer be accepted in forums organized in the North? Does this mean that forums in the North are impossible? The World Forum of Free Media affirms that freedom of expression for everyone, the right to information and communication, free access to knowledge are fundamental human rights that cannot be denied or affected by policies limiting the participation of people. We therefore call for the free circulation of people and invite all participants of the World Forum of Free Media and the World Social Forum to express our rejection and our protest to the Canadian authorities for it never to be repeated.
that was Gretchen King, and she's the co-organizer of the World Forum for Free Media. Well, as she said, one of the big issues that's going to be happening and is happening still right now is the refusal of visas to some of the people who wanted to come to attend both the World Forum of Free Media and also the World Social Forum. So there'll be more about that in the week to come, I'm sure. So Gretchen just gave us a little bit of an introduction. So now, Dave, I'm going to turn it over to you. You've been going out and you've been getting interviews and tape, and so you're going to be playing just some of the highlights of your day of exploration?
That's right, Victoria. I spent the better part of today in Leacock Hall at McGill University listening to presentations from a variety of folks, very interesting people from just about every continent on the planet, talking about popularizing the mass media, getting people involved at the grassroots, learning about media technology and broadcasting technology, and liberating media. And what I've put together here is a 9-minute sequence of voices. At the very beginning and at the end, you're going to hear a woman named Loreto Bravo, who is based in Oaxaca in Mexico. She works with a group called Palabra Radio, which means, I guess, radio of the word. It's a feminist collective engaged in popularizing media. Very interesting stuff about autonomous cell phone networks that they've been setting up. Actually, another group, but Palabra has been working with them, which can be used to do radio broadcasting. She's at the very beginning and at the very end. In between, you're going to hear Ramnath Bhat, who is a broadcaster from Bangalore in India and a longtime collaborator with the World Association of Radio Broadcasters. Interesting take, talking about liberating infrastructure with the use of things like offline Wi-Fi mesh networks, whatever
what is
they
that?
Are, because folks in the tribal areas in India are under enormous repression and actually don't trust the government to provide them with communications networks. They see them as kind of being mechanisms for oppressing people and keeping tags on people. That's Ram Bhat. And then after Ram, you're going to hear Moyele Shaware, who is based in New York City with an organization called SaharaReporters.com, but he's a Nigerian working to support Nigerian whistleblowers. And the point he makes is one that I really enjoy. You ready for this? That journalism cannot be left to professional journalists. So here you go. Loreto Bravo begins it off. And then you're going to hear Ramnath Bhat from AMARC and Moyele Shaware from Sahara Reporters. And at the very end, a little bit of Loreto again.
My name is Loreto Bravo. I'm original from Chile, but I lived the last 20 years in Mexico. And I am the coordinator of Palabra Radio. It's a collective, like a feminist collective. We have different projects. The main project is technical support for community radios, like build transmitters, repair, build antennas, adjust. And we have a audio production center to create content to share with community radios in Latin America.
What is an autonomous cell phone network?
This project consists in create GSM signal, like a cell phone signal in a small region. And so communities invest their resource, you know, to buy a transceiver. It's a equipment that can send and receive signal.
Cell phone signals.
It's radio frequency. And so you put the equipment in the community, create the signal with an antenna, connected to an antenna, and people under the area that is covered can use any kind of cell phones to connect with the network and make calls and text messages for $2.5 per month.
And they can be used to broadcast radio signals.
Yes, Yes.
Could you introduce yourself? Tell me who you are and where you come from and what brings you here to the World Social Forum, the message you're trying to get across, or messages.
Yeah, my name is Ram, and I work for a small arts and media collective in Bangalore, India. It's called Mara. And I'm on the international board of the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, AMARC. And I have a history of working in community radio and community media in the Asia-Pacific region. And I'm here at the World Forum on Free Media to talk about possible ways to think about media infrastructure. And I think most of the dominant way of thinking around media infrastructure is to fetishize access or to think in terms of the benefits it provides.
How so, fetishize access?
I mean, every country in the Asia-Pacific region has accepted the myth that if you invest in communications infrastructure, there will be a rise in GDP, there will be an increase in economic growth, there will be an increase in jobs, and so on and so forth.
So cell phone networks, internet access,
of course,
radio
of course,
stations.
Of course. But I don't think that's the view that all people hold, especially the subaltern peoples in the country, because a lot of tribal people are actually at war with the Indian Army. And communications is one way, especially electronic communications, is one way in which the state increases its surveillance over the people who are trying to fight it. And I think they have been resisting access. So roads, railway networks, telecommunication networks, internet networks are all ways of increasing the state's intrusion into their community.
And in your talk, you were describing this kind of a disjunct between the level of development in any given spot in India on one hand and the degree of communications infrastructure on the other.
Yeah, yeah.
So describe that disjunct to me.
I think what we have is basically a huge disjunct in the levels of access within India. So, for example, I'm just going to talk in terms of teledensity, right? So the number of phone lines per 100 people. So in urban areas of India, for example, a city like Bangalore or Delhi, you have teledensity of more than 150. Whereas in some of the tribal areas or the border areas where people are fighting for their survival, the teledensity is like 5%, 5. So there is virtually no telecommunication networks, there are no internet infrastructure, there's no electricity even in most places.
So Which is what you'd expect of the underdeveloped situation. In cities,
yes.
Places that are developed,
yes.
In other ways, there
yes.
is a very developed telecommunications
yes.
network, whereas
yes.
in underdeveloped areas,
yeah.
there isn't.
Yeah, but the state now is investing around $20 billion into setting up a countrywide optic fiber network. And the idea is that if the state invests in this, there will be a corresponding increase in development in these areas. And it's interesting to note that a lot of local communities are opposed to this idea of state coming in and putting in these infrastructures.
Tribal communities.
Yes, yes. Because it means easier mechanisms of surveillance. It's easier for states to monitor what is happening in these areas. It's much tougher for armed tribal groups or resisting corporate mining companies to fight back when there is an extensive optic fiber network.
It's easier to fight back when there isn't an extensive...
Yes, yes. When there isn't an extensive optic fiber, when there isn't an extensive network of roads, when there isn't an extensive network of railway networks. So communication infrastructures, my point is, are not always benign.
Okay, I'm Moyele Shore, and I'm the publisher and founder of SaharaReporters.com. I'm based in New York City, but I coordinate a network of citizen journalists out of Nigeria, and which is now fast expanding to even other African countries.
I enjoyed your comment that journalism is too important of an enterprise to be left to professional journalists.
That's correct. It has always been my position.
Why do you say that?
We have all seen that journalism, especially of the mainstream type, has become very oppressive because you saw how they are now embedded within the structures of power to the detriment of the mass. And my idea of communication is mass media, And and I think internet, this is the first time that we are giving Philip to the idea of mass media, because my idea of mass media is mass participation, mass distribution, and mass motivation to use media to do whatever they think, especially expanding their democratic freedoms. And that cannot be guaranteed by journalists. We cannot leave the idea of justice to lawyers. The same way you cannot leave the culture of health to doctors alone, because health is not about getting sick and walking into hospital and being operated upon or killed via therapy. It's bigger than that. Yeah. So, and the same way I look at journalism, you know, that simply that because somebody went to a journalism school does not give them the power or the right to determine how communication is carried out or how people communicate or which way they decide their communications to affect or promote their rights or lives.
Microsoft, Google, Facebook, either Carlos Slim, the main goal that they have is create this idea that technology is something very far away from the communities, from the knowledge that communities have. And we know that it's not true. Like, everybody can learn how work the technology. And so, for example, like all these companies is try to create homogenizar, how do you say that?
Homogenize
the culture in general. Like,
and they monopolize the technology.
Of course. This is the main goal that they have. Like, they want to monopolize the technology and create the idea that people that don't have this knowledge can't work in technology.
And so one of the themes, I think, in your talk was that people can capture those technologies and can liberate those technologies.
Yes, definitely. People are doing that. People all around the world, you know, like, exist a big free software movement liberating the software, exist a big open source movement liberating hardware, but we need to liberate our minds first, and then we can work with technology.
And that was Dave Kattenberg's collage of the different voices, some of the different voices anyway, that he heard today. I don't think that that little bit could even begin to encapsulate all the different things we heard, right? So I was ducking back and forth between press conferences for the World Social Forum and also at the World Forum of Free Media. And so I was able to take some time too and talk to some people who I know. And you got the international perspective, Dave. I got the national perspective. So here are a couple of people who I talked to about a couple of different issues, and I introduced them all, so I don't need to introduce them now. But anyway, here is a little bit of information and perspectives from Canada. We're sitting here outside and just enjoying being under the trees and everything, and I'm talking to Kathy Edwards, who has a petition to the Government of Canada in front of us. So can you tell us, what's this petition to the Government of Canada about?
Well, a recent CRTC decision, so the Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission, just redirected more than $100 million that used to support community media in Canada every year. It was collected from cable and satellite subscribers across the country for that specific purpose, to help them learn media skills and express themselves. They've just taken it away and directed it to fewer than a dozen private local news stations. So it's a huge hit to community media in Canada. It's the biggest pool of money there's ever been, and it's been used for that purpose dating back to the late 1960s. So it's a huge shift, and people should be scared.
Okay, so a little bit more background. I know some background on this because we've worked together on some stuff. But what we're talking about here is the money which is being redirected has come from the money which the cable companies used to have to spend on their Cable 14 or the community studio where people
that's
used to
right.
be able to come and do their own shows, right?
That's right.
So that's what's happening. That's the money. So now, does that mean that all of these community cable studios in town are going to be closed down?
Well, for the last 10 to 15 years, a lot of smaller ones have been closed anyways. As cable companies have fiber optically interconnected small towns into bigger networks, a lot of the studios had already disappeared, and they'd also started professionalizing the look and making it more slick, not necessarily more watchable, because all the funky alternative content disappeared in favor of, you know, slick staff-produced content.
So it hadn't... Ed the Sock was gone, for example. Didn't Ed the Sock come out of
I think Ed the
TV?
Sock was also actually CHCH in Hamilton. Wasn't that a private station?
No, I don't... Well, it's a private station, but I don't think... I think Ed the Sock was community TV, but okay. We're starting to get a little delirious here with too many...
No, that's okay. Complex. So for about a decade, they hadn't been doing a good job anyways, and community groups had been intervening, saying, look, it's old technology, people are disconnecting from cable, that money should be in community hands and administered by not-for-profits, like every other country in the world that has a community sector, and as in our own community radio sector. So, but the money was still on the books at the CRTC, supposed to be in community media. So we were hopeful they would finally get it, that the cable and satellite companies were not fulfilling this mandate, community should finally have the money, and what did they do? They gave it back to those same private, huge corporations for their private news stations. So the petition to Parliament is to ask that not necessarily that funding, because it needs to be something that the Heritage Minister and the Liberal government can get behind, but that we do need to have community media centres in communities where people of all stripes can go and learn media together, whether it's old media, new media, gaming, and have, you know, support and a company of colleagues to make content that's reflective of our communities and neighbourhoods.
And I'm talking to John Gagneau, and John is with Wawate. And it's a name that I know really, really well because I can remember Wawate has been around for a long, long time, hasn't it?
Yes, well, we got going. 1974 is when we really began with our newspaper. And then 77 was our first radio expansion, which started actually in Sandy Lake, First Nation. And it started off with its own controversy. Henry and Jenikinub was our first executive director at that point. And they had ordered 25 transmitters for 25 different communities. And the CRTC was going to put a stop to allowing these transmitters to be put up in our communities because of the wattage. And the reason CRTC gave them why we needed a license was that in case we overlapped any other frequencies. But as you know, the vast expanse of Northern Ontario, we were the only frequency up there outside of CBC and their repeater towers. So, of course, our great first leader decided to go against what CRTC recommended and put up the transmitters anyways. And CRTC ended up relenting and just offering licenses to the communities after it was said and done. So that's how radio got started up north. And then now we're based out of Timmins and Sioux Lookout, which are our two main production centers. We've been going pretty steady for a while. We've got a bit of an aging workforce because our original broadcasters, four of them are still with us. And they've been with us for almost 40 years, really, and starting in newspaper and then into the radio. So next year, we'll mark 40 years that they've been with us. So we're looking to expand and bring youth into the mix and looking for youth with language. So that's our niche, is that we broadcast in our languages. Which is Ojibwe, Oji-Cree, and Cree. And we're the foremost First Nation broadcaster in that sense in North America.
Now, you said something in your presentation this morning. It was about those transmitters which arrived in 1974, and you were making the point about, you know, who owns the air in Canada anyway? And this has always been, I think, something that isn't well understood, is when band councils say that they are self-licensing their own radio stations. Is that happening more often now and being accepted by the CRTC?
They still expect us to apply, but essentially, when our treaty was signed, there was no invention of radio yet, so airwaves weren't even considered something to divvy up. So, you know, of course, like our two stations in Timmins and Sioux Lookout do have licenses because we do overlap a municipality. So in that regard, we do follow the license agreements. But our communities, I think, got the original licenses, but most of them never renewed them. So those 25 communities that were established in 77 were, you know, they were asking recently, well, how about our licenses? And I'm thinking, as long as you have the broadcasting certificate from Industry Canada, that, you know, allows, gives you the call sign and where you're from, I say let's not worry about it, but let's not open a bag of, you know, potatoes if we don't need to. I think we have to revisit airspace and the spectrum for our own uses, and we have to look at, you know, asserting our rights to be able to offer licenses to our own communities. So I'd say, like, Anishinaabe Aski Nation, which is a PTO in our area.
What's a PTO?
Political Tribal Organization. So they look after the administration of all the communities within the Nan Territory, alongside with the tribal councils. And I think we'd have to start issuing licenses to ourselves. And it's just basically writing our own policies and creating our own politics around the spectrum. And it's something that we shouldn't have to get permission from Canada from, because our treaties are signed with the Crown, with England. Our treaties are not with Canada. Canada is just an offshoot of what happened with our treaties from early days. So, and now we're kind of stuck into this political red tape game with them.
Victoria, how do these voices modify your perspective on Canadian broadcasting, Canadian media, and what does it kind of get you thinking about what you'd like to do in Canada?
Well, I think the big thing that I was thinking about, especially after listening to Kathy Edwards and her petition to have the government support community television and community media centers, and basically to have us recognized as a sector. We are recognized in the Broadcast Act, but it's like it's not a very big mention and recognition. So I think that community media and alternative media is very fragile in Canada. I think that community media in Canada is both robust and fragile at the same time, if that makes any sense at all.
It does.
Yeah, because it's like, it seems that we're always on the brink, but we never fall over the brink. I don't know how.
It's incredibly vibrant, you know, listening to the people who presented on the international scene today and hearing the voices of some Canadian journalists. The cup is way more than half full.
For sure, and I think one of the biggest challenges is we have to keep refilling that cup. And people think, oh, well, a lot of people are volunteers who work in community media, so it doesn't cost anything. But it does cost a lot. You know, it's like we have transmitters to maintain. We have training programs. There is a certain infrastructure that we need. And it just reminds me, around the world, it's like we're all incredibly fragile, and not just because of money and monetary issues. I just listened to some of the people who have come from countries where community radio and is fairly new and free expression is not guaranteed, like some of the people who you talk to, Dave. And I keep thinking, it's pretty miraculous that we're here at all, isn't it?
Well, yes. You know, one of the most engaging presentations in this afternoon session in Leacock Hall was from a gentleman named Felix, who has been an extremely brave journalist in Honduras, reporting on human rights abuses that have been taking place since the 2009 coup, the murder of Berta Cáceres, speaking in Spanish together with a Canadian journalist who's been helping him out. The Real News Network actually picked up this story, and a presentation of the video was that newscast was presented. So it's really scary stuff when one thinks about the challenges facing journalists who are actually reporting on things and risking their own lives doing so. And this particular gentleman, Felix, received a gunshot right through his thigh from somebody who was trying to put him out of action. So it kind of, it raises the standard. It raises the mark and the bar for Canadian journalists who are making waves.
For sure. And so now I think it's about time. Oh, yeah, we're going a little bit over time here. So we are going to be back tomorrow. And the World Social Forum explores a lot of the same themes that we discussed today at the World Forum for Free Media. And so we'll have lots more information to bring you. So I'm Victoria Fenner, the executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network.
And I'm David Kattenberg.